human form. It is enough for our present purposes that he has instilled into people a dread of committing the crime of parricide, in view of the possibility that they might, all unknowing, come across the soul of an ancestor, and with a knife or teeth do it dreadful outrage, assuming that the spirit of a relative might be lodging in the flesh concerned. After setting out this theory, and supplementing it with arguments of his own, Sotion would say, "You cannot accept the idea of souls being assigned to one body after another, and the notion that what we call death is only a move to another home. You cannot accept that the soul which was once that of a man may sojourn in wild beasts, or in our own domestic animals, or in the creatures of the deep. You cannot accept that nothing ever perishes on this earth, instead merely undergoing a change in its whereabouts. And that the animal world, not just the heavenly bodies that revolve in their unalterable tracks, moves in cycles, with its souls propelled along an orbital path of their own. Well, the fact that these ideas are ones which have been accepted by great men should make you suspend judgment. You should preserve an open mind on the whole subject anyway. For if these ideas are correct, to abstain from eating the flesh of animals will mean guiltlessness, and even if they are not, it will still mean frugal living. What do you lose by believing in it all? All I am depriving you of is what the lions and the vultures feed on." Fired by this teaching, I became a vegetarian, and by the time a year had gone by, was finding it an enjoyable as well as an easy habit. I was beginning to feel that my mind was more active as a result of it, though I would not take my oath to you now that it really was. I suppose you want to know how I came to give up the practice. Well, my years as a young man coincided with the early part of Tiberius' reign, when certain religious cults of foreign origin were being promoted, and among other things, abstinence from certain kinds of animal food was regarded as evidence of adherence to such superstitions. So, at the request of my father, who did not really fear my being prosecuted, but who detested philosophy, I resumed my normal habits. And in fact, he had little difficulty in persuading me to adopt a fuller diet. Another thing, though, which Attalus used to recommend, was a hard mattress, and that is the kind I still use, even in my old age, the kind which shows no trace of a body having slept on it. I tell you all this just to show you the tremendous enthusiasm with which the merest beginner will set about attaining the very highest goals, provided someone gives him the necessary prompting and encouragement. Things tend, in fact, to go wrong. Part of the blame lies on the teachers of philosophy, who today teach us how to argue instead of how to live, part on their students, who come to the teachers in the first place with a view to developing not their character but their intellect. The result has been the transformation of philosophy, the study of wisdom, into philology, the study of words. The object which we have in view, after all, makes a great deal of difference to the manner in which we approach any subject. If he intends to become a literary scholar, a person examining his Virgil does not say to himself, when he reads that magnificent phrase, "Irrestorable, time flies," "We need to bestir ourselves. Life will leave us behind unless we make haste. The days are fleeting by, carried away at a gallop, carrying us with them. We fail to realize the pace at which we are being swept along. Here we are making comprehensive plans for the future and generally behaving as if we had all the leisure in the world when there are precipices all round us." No, his purpose is to note that Virgil invariably uses this word "flies" whenever he speaks of the swift passage of time. "Life's finest days, for us poor human beings, fly first. The sicknesses and sufferings, a bleak old age, the snatching hand, implacable of merciless death, creep near." It is the person with philosophy in his mind who takes these words in the way they are meant to be taken. Virgil, he says, never speaks of the hours as passing, but as flying, this being the swiftest form of travel. He is also telling us that the finest ones are the first to be borne away. Then why are we so slow to get ourselves moving, so as to be able to keep up with the pace of this swiftness of all things? The best parts of life are flitting by, the worse are to come. The wine which is poured out first is the purest wine in the bottle, the heaviest particles and any cloudiness settling to the bottom. It is just the same with human life. the best comes first. Are we going to let others drain it, so as to keep the dregs for ourselves? Let that sentence stick in your mind. Accept it as unquestioningly as if it had been uttered by an oracle. Life's finest days, for us poor human beings, fly first. Why finest? Because what is to come is uncertain. Why finest? Because while we are young, we are able to learn. When the mind is quick to learn and still susceptible to training, we can turn it to better ends. Because this is a good time for hard work, for studies as a means of keeping our brains alert and busy, and for strenuous activities as a means of exercising our bodies. The time remaining to us afterwards is marked by relative apathy and indolence, and is all the closer to the end. Let us act on this, then, wholeheartedly. Let us cut out all distractions and work away at this alone, for fear that otherwise we may be left behind and only eventually realize one day the swiftness of the passage of this fleeting phenomenon, time, which we are powerless to hold back. Every day as it comes shall be welcomed and reduced forthwith into our own possession, as if it were the finest day imaginable. What flies past has to be seized at. These thoughts never occur to someone who looks at the lines I have quoted through the eyes of our literary scholar. He does not reflect that our first days are our best days, for the very reason that the sicknesses creep near, with old age bearing down on us, hovering over our heads, whilst our minds are still full of our youth. No, his comment is that Virgil constantly couples sicknesses and old age, and not without good reason, I can tell you. I should describe old age itself as a kind of incurable sickness. The scholar further remarks on the epithet attached to old age, pointing out that the poet speaks in the passage quoted of bleak old age, and in another passage writes, "Where dwell wan sicknesses and bleak old age?" There is nothing particularly surprising about this way, whichever one has, of deriving material for his own individual interest from identical subject matter. In one and the same meadow, the cow looks for grass, the dog for a hare, and the stork for a lizard. When a commentator, a literary man, a devotee of philosophy, pick up Cicero's book The State, each directs his attention in different directions. The philosopher finds it astonishing that so much could have been said in it by way of criticism of justice. The commentator, coming to the very same reading matter, inserts this sort of footnote. "There are two Roman kings, one of whom has no father, and another no mother, the mother of Servius being a matter on which there is uncertainty, and Ancus, the grandson of Numa, having no father on record." He observes further that the man to whom we give the title dictator, and read about in the history books under the same name, was called the Master of the Commons by the early Romans. This title survives to the present day in the augural records, and the fact that the person appointed by him as his deputy was known as the Master of the Knights is evidence that this is correct. He similarly observes that Romulus died during an eclipse of the sun, that the right of appeal to the commons was recognized as early as the period of the monarchy. There is authority for this in the pontifical records, in the opinion of a number of scholars, in particular Fenestella. When the literary scholar goes through the same book, the first thing he records in his notebook is Cicero's use of reapse for re ipse, and sepse likewise for se ipse. He then goes on to examine changes in usage over the years, where, for example, Cicero uses the expression, "Since we have been called back right from the calques by this interruption of his," he notes that the calques was the name which the old Romans gave to the finishing line in the stadium, that we nowadays call the crater. The next thing he does is assemble lines from Ennius, and in particular those referring to Scipio of Africa. "None, foe nor Roman, can assess the value of his succour and do justice to his feats." From this passage, the scholar claims to deduce that the word succour to the early Romans signified the rendering not merely of assistance, but of actual services, Ennius saying that no one, foe or Roman, was capable of assessing the value of the services Scipio rendered Rome. Next, he congratulates himself on discovering the source from which Virgil chose to take the following, "above whose head the mighty gates of heaven thunder." He tells us that Ennius filched the idea from Homer, and that Virgil filched it from Ennius, there being a couplet of Ennius, preserved in this very work of Cicero's I was mentioning, The State, which reads, "If any man may rise to heaven's levels, to me alone lie open heaven's huge gates." But enough. Or before I know where I am, I shall be slipping into the scholar's or commentator's shoes myself. My advice is really this. What we hear the philosophers saying, and what we find in their writings, should be applied in our pursuit of the happy life. We should hunt out the helpful pieces of teaching, and the spirited and noble-minded sayings which are capable of immediate practical application, not far-fetched or archaic expressions or extravagant metaphors and figures of speech, and learn them so well that words become works. No one, to my mind, lets humanity down quite so much as those who study philosophy as if it were a sort of commercial skill, and then proceed to live in a quite different manner from the way they tell other people to live. People prone to the very fault they denounce are walking advertisements of the uselessness of their training. That kind of man can be of no more help to me as an instructor than a steersman who is seasick in a storm, a man who should be hanging on to the tiller when the waves are snatching it from his grasp, wrestling with the sea itself, rescuing his sails from the winds. What good to me is a vomiting and stupefied helmsman? And you may well think the storm of life is a great deal more serious than any which ever tosses a boat. What is needed is a steering hand, not talking. And apart from this, everything which this kind of man says, everything he tosses out to a thronging audience, belongs to someone else. The words were said by Plato, said by Zeno, said by Chrysippus and Posidonius, and a whole host more of Stoics like them. Let me indicate here how men can prove that their words are their own. Let them put their preaching into practice. Now that I've given you the message I wanted to convey to you, I'll go on from here to satisfy that wish of yours, but I'll transfer what you wanted from me to another fresh letter to avoid your coming mentally weary to a subject which is a thorny one and needs to be followed with a conscientious and attentive ear. Letter number 114. You ask why it is that at certain periods a corrupt literary style has come into being, and how it is that a gifted mind develops a leaning towards some fault or other, resulting in the prevalence at one period of a bombastic form of exposition, at another of an effeminate form, fashioned after the manner of songs, and why it is that at one time approval is won by extravagant conceits, and at another by sentences of an abrupt, elusive character, that convey more to the intelligence than to the ear, and why there have been eras in which metaphors have been shamelessly exploited. The answer lies in something that you hear commonly enough, something which among the Greeks has passed into a proverb. People's speech matches their lives. And just as the way in which each individual expresses himself resembles the way he acts, so in the case of a nation of declining morals and given over to luxury forms of expression at any given time, mirror the general behaviour of that society. A luxuriant literary style, assuming that it is the favoured and accepted style, and not just appearing in the odd writer here and there, is a sign of an extravagant society. The spirit and the intellect cannot be of different hues. If the spirit is sound, if it is properly adjusted, and has dignity and self-control, the intellect will be sober and sensible too. And if the former is tainted, the latter will be infected as well. You observe, surely, how a person's limbs drag and his feet dawdle along if his spirit is a feeble one, and how the lack of moral fibre shows in his very gait if his spirit is addicted to soft living, and how if his spirit is a lively and dashing one, his step is brisk, and how if it is prey to madness or the similar state of anger, his body moves along in an uncontrolled sort of way, in a rush rather than a walk. Isn't this all the more likely to be the case where a person's intellect is concerned, his intellect being wholly bound up with his spirit, moulded by and responsive to it and looking to it for guidance? The manner in which Maecenas lived is too well known for there to be any need to describe the way he walked, his self-indulgent nature, his passion for self-display, his reluctance that his fault should escape people's notice. Well then, wasn't his style just as undisciplined as his dress was sloppy? Wasn't his vocabulary just as extraordinary as his turnout, his retinue, his house, his wife? He would have been a genius if he had pursued a more direct path, instead of going out of his way to avoid being intelligible, had he not been as loose in manners of style as he was in everything else. Which is why you'll notice that his eloquence resembles a drunken man's, tortuous and rambling and thoroughly eccentric. Could there be a worse expression than the bank with mane of streams and woods? And look at men tilling with wherries the channel, driving in the gardens back with the shallows churning over. What about a person curvetting at a woman's beck, with lips on billing bent, a sigh the opening of his addresses, neck lolling like a forest giant in his ecstasy? The unregenerate company rummage homes for victuals, raiding them with provision jars and trading death for hope. But hardly should I call as witness on his holy day my guardian spirit, else the wick of a slender waxlight and sputtering meal. Mothers or wives accouter the hearth. When you read this sort of thing, doesn't it immediately cross your mind that this is the same man who invariably went around with casual clothes on in the capital, even when Maecenas was discharging the emperor's duties during the absence of Augustus? The officer coming to him for the daily code word would find him in informal attire, who appeared on the bench, on the platform, and at any public gathering, wearing a mantle draped over his head, leaving both ears exposed, looking just like the rich man's runaway slave, as depicted on the comic stage. The same man whose public escort, at a time when the nation was embroiled in a civil war, and the capital was under arms and in a state of alarm, consisted of a pair of eunuchs, and who went through 1,000 ceremonies of marriage with his one wife. These expressions of his, strung together in such an outrageous fashion, tossed out in such a careless manner, constructed with such a total disregard of universal usage, reveal a character equally revolutionary, equally perverted and peculiar. Maecenas' greatest claim to glory is regarded as having been his clemency. He spared the sword, refrained from bloodshed, and showed his power only in his defiance of convention. But he has spoilt this very claim of his by these monstrous stylistic frolics. For it becomes apparent that he was not a mild man, but a soft one. That perplexing word order, those transpositions of words and those startling ideas, which have indeed the quality of greatness in them, but which lose all their effect in the expression, will make it obvious to anyone that his head was turned by overmuch prosperity. It is a fault which is sometimes that of the man, and sometimes that of the age. Where prosperity has spread luxury over a wide area of society, people start by paying closer attention to their personal turnout. The next thing that engages people's energies is furniture. Then pains are devoted to the houses themselves, so as to have them running out over broad expanses of territory, to have the walls glowing with marble shipped from overseas, and the ceilings picked out in gold, to have the floors shining with a lustre matching the panels overhead. Splendour then moves on to the table, where praise is courted through the medium of novelty and variations in the accustomed order of dishes, making what normally rounds off a meal the first course, and giving people as they go what they used before to be given on arrival. Once a person's spirit has acquired the habit of disdaining what is customary, and regards the usual as banal, it starts looking for novelty in its methods of expression as well. At one moment it will disinter and revive archaic or obsolete expressions. At another it will coin new, unheard-of expressions, and give a word a new form. At another, this is something that has become very common recently, the bold and frequent use of metaphor passes for good style. There are some who cut their thoughts short and hope to win acclaim by making their meaning elusive, giving their audience a mere hint of it. There are others who stretch them out, reluctant to let them go. There are others still who do not merely fall into a defect of style, which is something that is inevitable if one is striving for any lofty effect, but have a passion for the defect for its own sake. So, wherever you notice that a corrupt style is in general favour, you may be certain that in that society, people's characters as well have deviated from the true path. In the same way as extravagance in dress and entertaining are indications of a diseased community, so an aberrant literary style, provided it is widespread, shows that the spirit from which people's words derive has also come to grief. And, in fact, you need feel no surprise at the way corrupt work finds popularity not merely with the common bystander, but with your relatively cultivated audience. The distinction between these two classes of critic is more one of dress than of discernment. What you might find more surprising is the fact that they do not confine themselves to admiring passages that contain defects, but admire the actual defects themselves as well. The former thing has been the case all through history. No genius that ever won acclaim did so without a measure of indulgence. Name me any man you like who had a celebrated reputation, and I'll tell you what the age he lived in forgave him, what it turned a blind eye to in his work. I'll show you plenty of stylists whose faults never did them any harm, and some who were actually helped by them. I'll even say this, I could show you some men of the highest renown, men held up as objects of wonder and admiration, in whose case to amend their faults would be to destroy them, their faults being so inextricably bound up with their virtues. Besides, there are no fixed rules of style. They are governed by the usage of society, and usage never stands still for any length of time. Many speakers hark back to earlier centuries for their vocabulary, talking in the language of the 12 tables. Gracchus, Crassus, and Curio are too polished and modern for them. They go right back to Appius and Coruncanius. Others, by contrast, in seeking to confine themselves to familiar, everyday expressions, slip into an undistinguished manner. Both these practices, in their different ways, are debased style, quite as much so as the rejection of any expression that is not high-sounding, florid, and poetical, avoiding the indispensable expressions in normal use. The one is as much a fault as the other, in my view, the first paying undue attention to itself, and the second unduly neglecting itself. The former removes the hair from its legs as well, the latter not even from its armpits. Let us turn our attention to composition. How many species of fault can I show you where this is concerned? Some like it broken and uneven, and go out of their way to disarrange any passage with a relatively smooth and even flow. They want every transition to come with a jolt, and see virility and forcefulness in a style the irregularities of which jar the ear. With some other literary figures, it is not a case of composition but of setting words to melodies, so sweetly, softly do they glide along. What shall I say about the kind in which words are held back and keep us waiting for a long time before they make their reluctant appearance right at the end of the period? What of that, like Cicero's, which moves to its conclusion in a leisurely fashion, in a gentle and delayed incline, and unvaryingly true to its customary rhythm? In the field of the epigram, too, faults comprise a tameness and childishness, or a boldness and daring that oversteps the bounds of decency, or a richness that has a cloying quality, or a barrenness in the outcome, an ineffectiveness, a ringing quality, and nothing more. These faults are introduced by some individual dominating letters at the time, are copied by the rest, and handed on from one person to another. Thus, in Sallust's heyday, abruptly terminated sentences, unexpectedly sudden endings, and a brevity carried to the point of obscurity, passed for a polished style. Lucius Aruntius, the historian of the Punic War, and a man of unusual simplicity of character, was a follower of Sallust, and strove after that kind of style. By means of money he procured an army. Hired one, in other words, is an expression found in Sallust. Aruntius took a fancy to this expression procured, and found a place for it on every page, saying in one passage, "They procured our rout." In another, "King Hero of Syracuse procured a war." And in another, "This news procured the surrender of the people of Panormus to the Romans." These are merely by way of giving you samples of the practice. The whole book is rife with them. What was occasional in Sallust is a frequent, almost incessant occurrence in Aruntius, which is easily enough explained, for whereas Sallust hit on such expressions, Aruntius cultivated them. You can see what the result is when some writer's fault is taken as a model. Sallust spoke of wintry rains. Aruntius, in the first book of the Punic War, says, "Suddenly the weather was wintry." In another place, when he wants to describe a particular year as having been a cold one, he says, "The whole year was wintry." In another passage he writes, "From there he dispatched 60 transport vessels, lightly laden, apart from troops and essential crew, in spite of a wintry northerly gale." He drags the word in constantly, in every conceivable place. Sallust at one point writes, "Seeking amid civil war the plaudits of rectitude and integrity." Aruntius was unable to restrain himself from inserting right at the beginning of his first book mention of Regulus's tremendous plaudits. Now, these faults and others like them, stamped on a writer's style by imitation, are not themselves evident of extravagant ways or corrupt attitudes. For the things upon which you base any judgment on a person's psychology must be things peculiar to himself, things that spring from his own nature. A hot-tempered man having a hot-tempered style, an emotional man an overexcited one, a self-indulgent man a soft and flabby one, and so on. And the last is the manner one observes adopted by the sort of person who has his beard plucked out, or has it plucked out in parts, who keeps himself close-shaven and smooth around his lips, but leaves the rest of it to grow, who wears cloaks in flamboyant colours, who wears a diaphanous robe, who is reluctant to do anything that might escape people's attention, who provokes and courts such attention, and, so long as he is looked at, does not mind whether it is with disapproval. Such is the manner of Maecenas, and every other writer whose stylistic errors are not accidental but deliberate and calculated. It is something that stems from a serious affliction of the spirit. When a person is drinking, his tongue only starts stumbling after his mental faculties have succumbed and given way or broken down. The same applies with this drunkenness, what else can one regard it as, of style. No one suffers from it unless his spirit is unstable. See, then, that the spirit is well looked after. Our thoughts and our words proceed from it. We derive our demeanour and expression and the very way we walk from it. If the spirit is sound and healthy, our style will be firm and forceful and virile. But if the spirit tumbles, all the rest of our personality comes down in ruins with it. The queen unharmed, the bees all live at one. Once she is lost, the hive's in anarchy. The spirit is our queen. So long as she is unharmed, the rest remains at its post, obedient and submissive. If she wavers for a moment, in the same moment the rest all falters. Letter number 122. The daylight has begun to diminish. It has contracted considerably, but not so much that there is not a generous amount remaining still for anyone who will, so to speak, rise with the daylight itself. More active and commendable still is the person who is waiting for the daylight and intercepts the first rays of the sun. Shame on him who lies in bed dozing when the sun is high in the sky, whose waking hours commence in the middle of the day. And even this time, for a lot of people, is the equivalent of the small hours. There are some who invert the functions of day and night, and do not separate eyelids leaden with the previous day's carousal before night sets in. Their way of life, if not their geographical situation, resembles the state of those peoples whom nature, as Virgil says, has planted beneath our feet on the opposite side of the world. And when dawn's panting steeds first breathe on us, for them the reddening evening starts at length to light their lamps. There are some Antipodes, living in the same city as ourselves, who, as Marcus Cato said, have never seen the sun rise or set. Can you imagine that these people know how one ought to live when they do not know when one ought to live? Can they really be afraid of death like other people, when this is what they have retreated into in their own lifetimes? They are as weird as birds that fly by night. They may while away their hours of darkness to a background of wine and perfume. They may occupy the whole of the time they spend contrarily awake, eating sumptuous dishes, individually cooked, too, in a long succession of different courses. But what in fact they are doing is not banqueting, but celebrating their own last rites. At least the dead have their memorial ceremonies during the daytime. Heavens, though, no day is a long one for a man who is up and about. Let us expand our life. Action is its theme and duty. The night should be kept within bounds, and a proportion of it transferred to the day. Poultry that are being reared for the table are cooped up in the dark, so as to prevent them moving about and make them fatten easily. There they languish, getting no exercise, with the swelling taking possession of their sluggish bodies, and the inert fat creeping over them in their magnificent seclusion. And the bodies of these people, who have dedicated themselves to the dark, have an unsightly look about them, too, inasmuch as their complexions are unhealthier looking than those of persons who are pale through sickness. Frail and feeble with their blanched appearance, in their case the flesh on the living person is death-like. And yet I should describe this as the least of their ills. How much deeper is the darkness in their souls? Their souls are dazed and befogged, envious of the blind. What man was ever given eyes for the sake of the dark? Do you ask how the soul comes to have this perverse aversion to daylight, and transference of its whole life to the night time? All vices are at odds with nature, all abandon the proper order of things. The whole object of luxurious living is the delight it takes in irregular ways, and in not merely departing from the correct course, but going to the farthest point away from it, and in eventually even taking a stand diametrically opposed to it. Don't you think it's living unnaturally to drink without having eaten, taking liquor into an empty system, and going on to dinner in a drunken state? Yet this is a failing which is common among young people, who cultivate their capacities to the point of drinking, swilling would be a better description of it, in naked groups, the moment they're inside the doors of the public bathhouse, every now and then having a rub all over to get rid of the perspiration brought on by continually putting down the piping hot liquor. To them, drinking after lunch or dinner is a common habit, something only done by rural worthies and people who don't know where the true pleasure lies. The wine that gives a person undiluted enjoyment, they say, is the wine that makes its way into his system unobstructed instead of swimming about in his food. Intoxication on an empty stomach is the kind that gratifies a man. Well, don't you think it's living unnaturally to exchange one's clothes for women's? Is it not living unnaturally to aim at imparting the bloom of youth to a different period of life? Can there be a sorrier or crueler practice than that whereby a boy is never apparently allowed to grow up into a man, in order that he may endure a man's attentions for as long as may be? Won't even his years rescue him from the indignity his sex ought to have precluded? Is it not living unnaturally to hanker after roses during the winter, and to force lilies in midwinter by taking the requisite steps to change their environment and keeping up the temperature with hot water heating? Is it not living unnaturally to plant orchards on the top of towers, or to have a forest of trees waving in the wind on the roofs and ridges of one's mansions, their roots springing at a height which it would have been presumptuous for their crests to reach? Is it not living unnaturally to seek the foundations of hot baths in the sea, and consider that one is not swimming in a refined fashion unless one's heated waters are exposed to the waves and storms? Having started to make a practice of desiring everything contrary to nature's habit, they finally end up by breaking off relations with her altogether. It's daylight, time for bed, all's quiet, now for our exercises, now for a drive, now for a meal. The daylight's getting nearer, time we had our dinner. No need to do as the crowd does, to follow the common, well-worn path of life is a sordid way to behave. Let's leave the daytime to the generality of people. Let's have early hours that are exclusively our own. This sort of person is to me as good as dead. After all, how far can a person be from the grave, and an untimely one at that, if he lives by the light of tapers and torches? I can recall a great many people who led this kind of life at one time, with a former praetor among them too, Acilius Buter, the man who had squandered an enormous fortune which he had inherited, and when he confessed his impoverished state to the Emperor Tiberius, was met with a remark, "You have woken up rather late." Montanus Julius, a tolerably good poet, noted for his closeness to Tiberius and subsequent fall from favour, who used to give public readings of his verse, took great delight in working sunrises and sunsets into his compositions. Hence the remark of Nutter Penarius, when someone was expressing disgust at the way Montanus' reading had continued for a whole day, and declaring that his readings weren't worth attending. "I'm quite prepared to listen to him, can I say fairer than this, from sunrise to sunset." When Montanus had just read the lines, "The sun god starts his fiery flames to extend the rosy dawn to diffuse her light, and now that plaintive bird, the swallow, starts to thrust her morsels down the throats of nestlings shrill, with gentle bill supplying each its share with journeys yet to come." One Varus called out, "And Buter starts to sleep!" Varus was a Roman knight, a friend of Marcus Vinicius, who was always in attendance at good dinners, for which he used to qualify by the sauciness of his tongue. It was he, too, who said a little later on, when Montanus had read, "The herdsmen now in byres have stalled their beasts, and night now starts to bring the drowsy world a dreamy stillness." "What's that, you say? Night, is it, now? I'll go and pay a morning call on Buter." Buter's upside-down way of life was a byword. And yet, as I've said, at one time this sort of life was led by a great many people. The reason why some people live in this sort of way is not that they think that night itself has any special attraction, but that they get no pleasure out of anything which is usual, apart from the fact that daylight is anathema to a bad conscience. A person who experiences a craving or a contempt for things in proportion to their costliness or cheapness looks down his nose at a form of illumination which does not cost him anything. Moreover, the man who lives extravagantly wants his manner of living to be on everybody's lips as long as he is alive. He thinks he is wasting his time if he is not being talked about, so every now and then he does something calculated to set people talking. Plenty of people squander fortunes, plenty of people keep mistresses. To win any reputation in this sort of company, you need to go in for something not just extravagant, but really out of the ordinary. In a society as hectic as this one, it takes more than common profligacy to get oneself talked about. I once heard that delightful storyteller, Albinovenus Pedo, describing how he had lived above Sextus Papinius. Papinius was one of the daylight shy fraternity. "About 9 o'clock at night, I'd hear the sound of whips. 'What's he doing?' I'd ask, and be told he was inspecting the household accounts. About 12, I'd hear some strenuous shouting. 'What's that?' I'd ask, and be told he was doing his voice exercises. About 2, I'd ask what the noise of wheels meant, and be told he was off for his drive. About daybreak, there would be a scurrying in all directions, a shouting for boys, and a chaos of activity among stewards and kitchen staff. 'What is it?' I'd ask, to be told he was out of his bath and had called for his pre-dinner appetizer. His dinner, then, it might be said, exceeded the capacity of his day. Far from it, for he lived in a highly economical fashion. All he used to burn up was the night." Hence Pedo's remark, when some people were describing Papinius as being mean and grasping, "I take it you were describing as being an artificial light addict as well." You needn't be surprised to discover so much individuality where the vices are concerned. Vices are manifold, take countless different forms, and are incapable of classification. Devotion to what is right is simple. Devotion to what is wrong is complex and admits of infinite variations. It is the same with people's characters. In those who follow nature, they are straightforward and uncomplicated, and differ only in minor degree, while those that are warped are hopelessly at odds with the rest, and equally at odds with themselves. But the chief cause of this disease, in my opinion, is an attitude of disdain for a normal existence. These people seek to set themselves apart from the rest of the world, even in the manner in which they organize their timetable, in just the same way as they mark themselves off from others by the way they dress, by the stylishness of their entertaining, and the elegance of their carriages. People who regard notoriety as a reward for misbehaviour have no inclination for common forms of misbehaviour. And notoriety is the aim of all these people who live, so to speak, back to front. We therefore, Lucilius, should keep to the path which nature has mapped out for us, and never diverge from it. For those who follow nature, everything is easy and straightforward, whereas for those who fight against her, life is just like rowing against the stream. Letter number 123. I have reached my house at Alba at last, late at night, and worn out by the journey, which wasn't so much long as thoroughly uncomfortable, to find nothing ready for my arrival, apart from myself. So I'm in bed, recovering from my fatigue, and making the best of this slowness on the part of the cook and the baker, by carrying on a conversation with myself on this very theme, of how nothing is burdensome if taken lightly, and how nothing need arouse one's irritation, so long as one doesn't make it bigger than it is by getting irritated. My baker may be out of bread, but the farm manager will have some, or the steward, or a tenant. Bad bread, yes, you'll say. Wait, then. It'll soon turn into good bread. Hunger will make you find even that bread soft and wheaty. One shouldn't, accordingly, eat until hunger demands. I shall wait, then, not eat until I either start getting good bread again, or cease to be fussy about bad bread. It is essential to make oneself used to putting up with a little. Even the wealthy and the well-provided are continually met and frustrated by difficult times and situations. It is in no man's power to have whatever he wants, but he has it in his power not to wish for what he hasn't got, and cheerfully make the most of the things that do come his way. And a stomach firmly under control, one that will put up with hard usage, marks a considerable step towards independence. I'm deriving immeasurable satisfaction from the way my tiredness is becoming reconciled to itself. I'm not asking for masseurs, or a hot bath, or any remedy except time. What was brought on by exertion, rest is taking away, and whatever kind of meal is on the way is going to beat an inaugural banquet for enjoyment. I have, in fact, put my spirit to a good sort of test, and a surprise one, too, such a test being a good deal more candid and revealing. When the spirit has prepared itself beforehand, has called on itself in advance to show endurance, it is not so clear just how much real strength it possesses. The surest indications are the ones it gives on the spur of the moment, when it views annoyances in a manner not merely unruffled, but serene, when it refrains from flying into a fit of temper, or picking a quarrel with someone, when it sees to everything it requires by refraining from hankering after this and that, reflecting that one of its habits may miss a thing, but its own real self need never do so. Until we have begun to go without them, we fail to realize how unnecessary many things are. We've been using them not because we needed them, but because we had them. Look at the number of things we buy because others have bought them, or because they're in most people's houses. One of the causes of the troubles that beset us is the way our lives are guided by the example of others. Instead of being set to rights by reason, we're seduced by convention. There are things that we shouldn't wish to imitate if they were done by only a few, but when a lot of people have started doing them, we follow along as though a practice became more respectable by becoming more common. Once they have become general, mistaken ways acquire in our minds the status of correct ones. Nobody travels now without a troop of Numidian horsemen riding ahead of him, and a host of runners preceding his carriage. One feels ashamed not to have men with one, to hustle oncoming travellers off the road, and to show there's a gentleman coming by the cloud of dust they raise. Everybody nowadays has mules to carry his crystalware, his myrrhine vessels, and the other articles engraved by the hands of master craftsmen. One is ashamed to be seen to have only the kind of baggage which can be jolted around without coming to any harm. Everyone's pages ride along with their faces smeared with cream, in case the sun or the cold should spoil their delicate complexions. One is ashamed if there is no member of one's retinue of boys whose healthy cheeks call for protection with cosmetics. With all such people you should avoid associating. These are the people who pass on vices, transmitting them from one character to another. One used to think that the type of person who spreads tales was as bad as any, but there are persons who spread vices, and association with them does a lot of damage, for even if its success is not immediate, it leaves a seed in the mind, and even after we've said goodbye to them, the evil follows us to rear its head at some time or other in the future. In the same way as people who've been to a concert carry about with them the melody and haunting quality of pieces they've just heard, interfering with their thinking and preventing them from concentrating on anything serious, so the talk of snobs and parasites sticks in our ears long after we've heard it. And it's far from easy to eradicate these haunting notes from the memory. They stay with us, lasting on and on, coming back to us every so often. This is why we must shut our ears against mischievous talk, and as soon as it starts, too. Once such talk has made its entry and been allowed inside, it becomes a good deal bolder. Eventually it reaches the stage where it says that virtue and philosophy and justice are just a lot of claptrap. There's only one way to be happy, and that's to make the most of life. Eating, drinking, spending the money that's been left to you. That's what I call living. And that's what I call not forgetting that you've got to die some day too. The days are slipping by, and life is running out in us, never to be restored. Why should we hesitate? What's the point of being wise? Our years won't always allow us a life of pleasure, and in the meantime, while they're capable of it and clamouring for it, what's the point of thrusting austerity on them? Steal a march on death by disposing here and now of whatever he is going to take away. Look at you, no mistress, no boy to make your mistress jealous. Every day you go out sober, you eat as if you had to submit a daily account book to your father for approval. That's not living. That's merely being a part of the life enjoyed by other people. And what madness it is to deny yourself everything and so build up a fortune for your heir, a policy which has the effect of actually turning a friend into an enemy through the very amount that you're going to leave him, for the more he's going to get, the more gleeful he's going to be at your death. As for those sour and disapproving characters, those critics of other people's lives and spoilers of their own, who set themselves up as moral tutors to society at large, you needn't give tuppence for them. You needn't ever have any hesitation when it comes to putting good living before a good reputation. These are voices you must steer clear of, like those which Ulysses refused to sail past until he was lashed to the mast. They have the same power. They lure men away from country, parents, friends, and moral values, creating expectations in them, only to make sport out of the wretchedness of lives of degradation. How much better to pursue a straight course, and eventually reach that destination where the things that are pleasant and the things that are honourable finally become for you the same. And we can achieve this if we realise that there are two classes of things attracting or repelling us. We are attracted by wealth, pleasures, good looks, political advancement, and various other welcoming and enticing prospects. We are repelled by exertion, death, pain, disgrace, and limited means. It follows that we need to train ourselves not to crave for the former, and not to be afraid of the latter. Let us fight the battle the other way round. Retreat from the things that attract us, and rouse ourselves to meet the things that actually attack us. You know the difference, Lucilius, between the postures people adopt in climbing up and descending a mountain. Those coming down on a slope lean back. Those moving steeply upwards lean forward. For to tilt one's weight ahead of one when descending, and backwards when ascending, is to be in league with what one has to contend with. The path that leads to pleasures is the downward one. The upward climb is the one that takes us to rugged and difficult ground. Here let us throw our bodies forward. In the other direction, rein them back. Are you now supposing that the only people I consider a danger to our ears are the ones who glorify pleasure and indicate in us a dread, itself a fearsome thing, of pain? No, I think we're also damaged by the people who urge us, under colour of Stoic beliefs, to do what's wrong. They make much of our principle that only a man of wisdom and experience can really love. He's the one man with a natural gift for the art of love-making, then, they say, and is equally in the best position to know all about drink and parties. Well, here's a question for discussion. Up to what age is it proper to love young men? This sort of thing may be all right for the Greeks, but the kind of talk to which we would be better to turn our ears is this. No man's good by accident. Virtue has to be learnt. Pleasure is a poor and petty thing. No value should be set on it. It's something we share with dumb animals. The minutest, most insignificant creatures scutter after it. Glory's an empty, changeable thing, as fickle as the weather. Poverty's no evil to anyone unless he kicks against it. Death is not an evil. What is it, then? The one law mankind has that is free of all discrimination. Superstition is an idiotic heresy. It fears those it should love. It dishonours those it worships. For what difference does it make whether you deny the gods or bring them into disrepute? These are things which should be learnt, and not just learnt, but learnt by heart. Philosophy has no business to supply vice with excuses. A sick man who is encouraged to live in a reckless manner by his doctor has not a hope of getting well. Appendix. Tacitus' account of Seneca's death. Translated by Michael Grant. Nero asked if Seneca was preparing for suicide. Gavius Silvanus replied that he had noticed no signs of fear or sadness in his words or features. So Silvanus was ordered to go back and notify the death sentence. According to one source, he did not return by the way he had come, but made a detour to visit the commander of the guard, Finius Rufus. He showed Finius the emperor's orders, asking if he should obey them. And Finius, with that ineluctable weakness which they all revealed, told him to obey. For Silvanus was himself one of the conspirators, and now he was adding to the crimes which he had conspired to avenge. But he shirked communicating or witnessing the atrocity. Instead, he sent in one of his staff officers to tell Seneca he must die. Unperturbed, Seneca asked for his will, but the officer refused. Then Seneca turned to his friends. "Being forbidden," he said, "to show gratitude for your services, I leave you my one remaining possession and my best, the pattern of my life. If you remember it, your devoted friendship will be rewarded by a name for virtuous accomplishments." As he talked, and sometimes in sterner and more imperative terms, he checked their tears and sought to revive their courage. Where had their philosophy gone, he asked, and that resolution against impending misfortunes which they had devised over so many years? "Surely nobody was unaware that Nero was cruel," he added. "After murdering his mother and brother, it only remained for him to kill his teacher and tutor." These words were evidently intended for public hearing. Then Seneca embraced his wife and, with a tenderness very different from his philosophical imperturbability, entreated her to moderate and set a term to her grief and take just consolation in her bereavement from contemplating his well-spent life. Nevertheless, she insisted on dying with him, and demanded the executioner's stroke. Seneca did not oppose her brave decision. Indeed, loving her wholeheartedly, he was reluctant to leave her for ill treatment. "Solace in life was what I commended to you," he said, "but you prefer death and glory. I will not grudge your setting so fine an example. We can die with equal fortitude, but yours will be the nobler end." Then, each with one incision of the blade, he and his wife cut their arms. But Seneca's aged body, lean from austere living, released the blood too slowly, so he also severed the veins in his ankles and behind his knees. Exhausted by severe pain, he was afraid of weakening his wife's endurance by betraying his agony, or of losing his own self-possession at the sight of her sufferings. So he asked her to go into another bedroom. But even in his last moment, his eloquence remained. Summoning secretaries, he dictated a dissertation. It has been published in his own words, so I shall refrain from paraphrasing it. Nero did not dislike Paulina personally. In order, therefore, to avoid increasing his ill repute for cruelty, he ordered her suicide to be averted. So, on instructions from the soldiers, slaves and ex-slaves bandaged her arms and stopped the bleeding. She may have been unconscious, but discreditable versions are always popular, and some took a different view, that as long as she feared there was no appeasing Nero, she coveted the distinction of dying with her husband, but when better prospects appeared, life's attractions got the better of her. She lived on for a few years, honourably loyal to her husband's memory, with pallid features and limbs which showed how much vital blood she had lost. Meanwhile, Seneca's death was slow and lingering. Poison, such as was formerly used to execute state criminals at Athens, had long been prepared, and Seneca now entreated his well-tried doctor, who was also an old friend, to supply it. But when it came, Seneca drank it without effect, for his limbs were already cold and numbed against the poison's action. Finally, he was placed in a bath of warm water. He sprinkled a little of it on the attendant slaves, commenting that this was his libation to Jupiter. Then he was carried into a vapour bath, where he suffocated. His cremation was without ceremony, in accordance with his own instructions about his death, written at the height of his wealth and power. We hope you have enjoyed this Penguin audio production of Letters from a Stoic by Seneca, read by Julian Glover. It was produced by Chris Thompson, and the post-production was by Heavy Entertainment. For more Penguin audio productions, visit us at penguin.co.uk/audio. Thanks for listening. Copyright and recording, Penguin Audio, 2019. Text copyright, first published by Penguin Books in 1969. Introduction copyright, Robin Alexander Campbell, 1969. All rights reserved. The moral rights of the author have been asserted.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.